We're back in the third hour of Stand Up on Wednesday. We always invite and often are joined by our next guest, Dr. Aaron Carroll, and he is here today. We're very happy to have him joining us as always. He is, well, he's many things. His intro is getting longer and longer. He is now a contributor to the New York Times Upshot. And just this week, he was on the front page of NewYorkTimes.com, which is very exciting and surreal. He blogs at the Incidental Economist all the time. He has written a couple of books about medical myths. Don't cross your eyes. They'll get stuck that way. Don't swallow your gum as well is the first one. He's got one coming out about sex myths as well. And he's a doctor. He's a professor of pediatrics and the director of Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University, which is where he joins us from, at Aaron E. Carroll. Oh, and I forgot to mention healthcare triage. Was there a healthcare triage this week? Did I miss the last one?
There was one on Monday about tort reform. It's a good one.
Oh, really? I didn't see that one. And I do subscribe and get the emails. I must have missed the email. You did a tort reform debunkage.
Yes.
Wow. How many minutes does that go for?
Well, you know, only about five, actually. 5:17.
You know what's interesting about the issue of cost? It's very easy to be convinced that the issue, the reason why healthcare costs so much is because doctors are worried about being sued, and so they do so many tests. But the reason why they do so many tests isn't nearly as much because of a concern of a malpractice lawsuit as it is they get paid every test, right?
Well, I think here's the thing. I don't want to ascribe any motives because you can never know what's in
store. Sure.
But we all know 10-cent coupons work. They, you know, small financial incentives drive people's behavior. That has been shown in tons and tons of sociological research. So we're not debating that. That's why financial incentives exist. So if there's a massive financial incentive to do a procedure, to do a test, even if it is subconscious, of course fee-for-service in that manner is going to drive, you know, human behavior. To deny that would be to deny that, like, coupons or rebates or sales or any kind of financial incentive works. And so what research has shown is that even when you remove the malpractice threat, even when you sort of, you know, reduce premiums or look at doctors in low or high-risk areas of being sued, it really doesn't affect healthcare spending that much. It just doesn't, because, you know, the reasons that doctors do stuff, the order test, is often because, you know, just human nature. Also, they don't want to miss stuff. They want to be conservative, and also because they make money when they do that. And so all of that conspires together to get healthcare spending high. Removing malpractice threat doesn't seem to really affect healthcare spending that much. And even if that were the case, tort reform has not been shown to actually reduce malpractice threat, because that involves a whole cascade of events, which would require insurance companies, when they see lower indemnity payments and lower lawsuits, to actually lower premiums, which often doesn't occur. Watch the video. 5:17 explains the whole thing.
Well, the other thing, though, about tort reform, and this is not only in medical malpractice, but, you know, there's a great documentary called Hot Coffee, and the idea is we've had these touchstone moments that have gone kind of viral before the internet even, about, you know, these stories are so outrageous that a woman sued McDonald's because she got burnt by their coffee. The truth about that story is much different. And when you see the pictures of the woman's burns, that is pretty convincing, all over inner thighs and lady parts. It's horrific. But, yeah. but so much of what we heard about a lawsuit isn't true. The money was never awarded. And so, you know, and by the way, you know, if you have an issue at a hospital when your child is born and the child, you know, then suffers from, say, you know, cerebral palsy or something the rest of his life because a doctor did something wrong, that kid's life needs to be funded.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing.
It's a lot of money to fund a life.
And it's like the statistics on this are interesting, but it's like, but of, you know, all hospitalizations, a very small percentage are due to some sort of malpractice. But what's even more disturbing is that a very small percentage of those cases actually become claims. And so we have a malpractice system where one of the things you have to be cognizant of is that far, far, far too few real claims actually go anywhere. It's an incredibly small percent, like 2% or something. So you have tons and tons of people who've actually been harmed by the medical system who don't do anything, who get nothing. And then, of course, there's the other side where we have far too many actual cases which clog up the system and cost a lot of money, which are not without merit. And so we have it broken on both sides and only fixing one, only trying to reduce the number of claims overall, absolutely does not serve the real issue of that many, many people are harmed by the healthcare system who don't get any benefit at all. And that is real harm. I have seen real malpractice cases of people who have been really injured. I think we even talked about one on the radio. There was a story out of Texas. It was horrific. And there were arguments being made that it was allowed to happen for so long because of many of the things that they had passed just to try to reduce the ability of people to bring cases to court where a surgeon was truly harming people, truly out of control and harming people. And there was no recourse. And that is a real problem that really exists, and people need real money sometimes to be compensated for it to take care of the issues that result from it.
Let's go to the phones. 866-994-6343 is the phone number. Mario in New Jersey and I were up late together last night.
A lot of fun.
Tweeting back and forth. I urge you to go look at those tweets. Mario's very funny. And I had a couple zingers myself. What were our hashtags that we were using?
I'm not a scientist, but.
Yeah. It's the John Boehner, I'm not qualified, Dr. Carroll, to comment on climate change.
Yeah, I'm not a scientist, but I've heard that copious milk consumption is vital to human health.
Okay, I'm just going to let that one go by.
Now, I just brushed my teeth, so forgive me if this is a stupid question.
Yes.
Because I heard fluoride makes you really dumb.
Okay.
But let me ask you this. Do you think that a doctor should be responsible for referring people to their network and their insurance? I know people have to have the responsibility, but it's difficult for people, it seems to me.
But the truth of the matter is it's difficult for doctors, too. And to think that doctors have some sort of special insight into what is in any insurance. Look, I am about...
Wait, what's he asking, Aaron?
In other words, he's saying it's different when a doctor says, "Okay, you need a specialist." Often doctors will sometimes say, "You need a specialist. Do you have one that you like?" Or they will say, "Hey, I know someone who's good. I'll refer you to them." But what people obviously need in the future and now is to be referred to doctors that are in their network, because insurance often has narrow networks. They don't want to be referred to somebody who's out of their network, which would cost much more money.
Right.
And so it's difficult for patients. And Mario is asking, you know, should it be the doctor's responsibility to know who's in the patient's network so that they can refer them to somebody who's actually in the network? But, you know, doctors are no more clued in to how the networks of insurance companies work than patients are. As I was about to say, I'm about as expert in this as anybody I know. I have difficulty figuring out who's in my network and who's not. You know, I still have to go to the website and type it in and try to figure it out and often make a phone call to figure out if somebody's in network or not. And even then, I'm not totally sure. You know, you never feel totally comfortable. And this is what I do for a living. You know, there is no good way at this time for many insurance companies to find out who is in and out of network. And I think that putting it on doctors would just be adding on more administrative burden to their offices, which would raise spending and waste time and probably lead to bad outcomes. And they are no more equipped or knowledgeable about this than any other human being would be. It is not their skill set either. So we need a better system. I absolutely agree, but I don't think doctors are the answer.
Yeah, people definitely need to be cognizant of it for themselves, because even simple stuff as blood work, right? They can send you to a lab that's not covered.
Oh my God, I have to have blood work drawn every few months, and I cannot. It's so frustrating, because every time it feels like when I go to the website, they have changed their agreements with which labs that they are covering and which is going to be free or which would not be. I have to then go get another prescription because the standing orders that were held in my old lab have to be redone. And so I have to somehow contact my doctor and get them to reauthorize the lab orders. And then I have to remember to bring. And it's a nightmare. And this is me. I mean, I have written about this multiple times in the blog. My frustration of filling my prescriptions, my frustration of getting my labs because they continue to make new deals, and it is incumbent upon me as a patient to figure this out and be responsible for it every time. And I'm equipped to do this. There are lots and lots of people who are not, and I cannot imagine their frustration.
Well, congratulations on the spot in the Times, by the way. I saw
Thank
that.
You.
That was great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mario. Mario, by the way, is on Twitter, at Mario J. Russo. We were going back and forth last night. He had some really funny ones, Aaron. He said... I'm not a scientist, but now I can't find them all. But immigrants have these calves the size of cantaloupes. I'm butchering them all.
Oh, jeez.
I can't believe it. Can't find them. All right, let's go to John in Ohio. Hi, John. You're on with @AaronEcarroll.
Hey, Dr. Carroll. I just wanted to follow up on that question. I feel like a lot of times now with doctors being bought out by hospitals and group specialty and general practice, they refer within that group where they're all owned by the same hospital.
Absolutely.
And I think we should have to, as a customer, you should be told that this person is in my group and there's a financial benefit to me. Because if the hospital does better, and then also if you go to a surgery center that's owned by the doctor, I feel like the doctor has to tell you that there's a financial benefit that I'm choosing this surgery center over going to the hospital or somewhere else.
You feel like the doctor should have to convey his conflict of interest, his or her?
Yeah, I would actually separate those out slightly, though, because we should always remember that the conflicts of interest are almost unavoidable. Because they're not just financial, sometimes they're professional. So all conflicts of interest always exist. I think that the way we deal with them is to be honest and open about them and try to make good arrangements to make sure that they don't overly influence our decision. So I wouldn't just say that like all conflicts of interest are the same. Those are two separate things. The doctor who owns the surgery center is getting an absolute direct financial benefit from sending you there. The doctor that is referring you in network, that is a, you know, far down the line. That certainly benefits a hospital or a healthcare system. But the doctor himself, especially if he's on salary, isn't getting necessarily like a financial benefit, like a kickback or profit sharing.
Well, they get bonus. They usually get bonus on how well the hospital or the network does.
There are rarely bonuses based, because almost all many hospitals, you have to remember, are nonprofit. So there's no bonus based on profit. Now they may be told, it's good, but there are also real benefits. I have to be honest, of referring in system that should not be overlooked. If you're referring in system, then the medical record is definitely internal, which means that you know that all the data will be there. If you refer in system, you know that you won't have likely a duplication of tests or labs, because you will be able to know and access those that have already been there. If you refer in system, you know that there's more control of the scheduling appointments and care coordination. It's easier to keep a medical home. There are a lot of absolutely valid reasons that I would say that there's good evidence that shows that actually might lead to better quality. So there's something to be managed there, to be said, like, okay, I know that there's a conflict of interest, but we need to make sure that the profit motive doesn't. Because, again, I think you'd be surprised that very few doctors who work in hospitals are in some sort of profit-sharing plan. They may be on some sort of clinical bonus by their productivity. In other words, how many patients do they see? But that benefits them. They can't refer to themselves. So a referral doesn't necessarily get you a bonus. Seeing patients and seeing more patients would get you a bonus. There's not as much of a direct line there. Referring to your own surgical center if you owned the hospital, though, yes, of course, that would be a direct financial benefit. And that is the kind of thing that I think Congress especially has been much more concerned about, and there has been lots of arguments in the past over whether this is legal, whether this is violates antitrust laws, and there are some, I believe that there are some places where those kinds of relationships are frowned upon, or it is illegal, it has been, or plus minus illegal in the past to refer to yourself, but that absolutely does occur, and that should, I think,
what do you think, John?
That should be disclosed.
Well, I think number one is you should always refer, the doctor should refer to the best specialist there is.
Totally
agree.
That
worker out.
But
I think that's where the cloudy gets things, where the hospital owns your practice, or they say, well, you refer to the pediatric cardiologist in our group, even if there's a better one down the street.
I'm going to challenge you on that, because this is one of those sort of gray areas where people think it's cut and dry, and it is so gray. What do we mean when we say best cardiologist?
There's a doctor who can apprise a situation and make a medical decision that's competent. I mean, you probably know some doctors who you aren't comfortable using because you've seen them make decisions that you have seen be erroneous or wrong.
That's
and you've
exactly.
seen other
so
ones
easy,
who are good medical clinical thinkers.
But you just defined what a bad doctor is, and I would say it's very easy for most doctors to identify a bad doctor. But how do we identify the best doctor?
Hmm.
I think it's
that's so much harder.
Isn't it just the number of stars given on a website?
Well, but you can. So is it how pleasant they are? Is it their bedside manner? Yeah. Is it like how many?
It could be a number of. It could be.
So we often I think people assume that doctors, when they're like, "Well, he's not sending me to the best," I would wager in almost every case the doctor in their head thinks they're the best because it might even be like he's the nicest.
How modern is their office? Do they perform surgery on celebrities?
Well, it is such a very rare, varied thing. I think it is very rare, very, 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 very rare, where a doctor would send a patient to someone that they know to be incompetent because it is in their financial interest. I think that they are often swayed by whatever metric is in their head at the moment to believe in their hearts that this is the best decision for the patient. Because I will be honest with you, like, I know doctors who just assume that because they work in a certain hospital that everybody who works in that hospital is the best that there is. That's what they think. And we don't have objective measurements.
Let John get the last word in here, and I'll wrap it up.
Yeah, sure.
John.
I just wanted to say, well, I think the best doctor is somebody who can apprise the situation, make a good clinical decision, listen to all of what the patient's complaints are, and go ahead and think outside of the think within the box and make a decision based on their historical experiences. That's what I think
a
good doctor.
Well,
how do we measure that?
Well, by what you've seen in the past. When you live in a community, you see how doctors interact. You interact with them. You talk to other doctors, and you say, wow, he really made me think a little harder, or he thought that situation, and maybe I should send another doctor to him. Like a radiologist, you'll send patients to radiologists, and they'll come back and say, you know, I looked really hard, and I saw this. And you'll see other reports from radiologists, and you'll say, wow, that was just a broad scope thing. Like, oh, could possibly be this without any. You know,
well, first of all,
you never
get to choose a radiologist. So that is moot. I mean, that's just whoever's employed by the hospital where it is. But here, I want to actually, this is a great topic, so I'd like to push it a little further.
All right, but is Dr. Oz a great doctor?
Well, again.
Sanjay Gupta?
I don't know. So
what about Dr. J?
This is actually serious, so I want to talk about it for 1 second.
Seuss?
When I would say that, you know, if you sit me around with five other doctors that practice locally, I'm sometimes amazed by who they think is a good doctor, who I think is not a good doctor, and how the opposite actually occurs. And what I've realized over time is that this is what you think is a good doctor. But when my friends come to me and say, like, hey, I need a new primary care doc, the first thing I say to them is, like, what kind of doctor are you looking for? Are you a minimalist? Or are you someone who's a constant worrier who wants every test that could possibly be done to make sure you're better? Are you someone that needs their hand held? Or are you someone that wants to spend no time sort of like discussing how your family is and everything else or, you know, what's going on with your life? You just want to get in, get the test, and get out. Because that's what I want. I don't need a hand holder. My doctor is very business-like, cut and dry, asks the questions, gets the answers. We do our stuff. We move and go. I don't need anything else. I feel like I know what's going on most of the time. I need her to think of the things that I'm not. That's what I'm looking for. I know people who completely dislike her because they think that, you know, she's cold and she's unfeeling and she doesn't have a good bedside manner and that she's, you know, not careful enough because she doesn't order all the tests that you should get. And I feel exactly the opposite. And
what's her name?
No, I'm not saying that. So I will refer my own friends to very different people based upon what they perceive a good doctor to be. And I try to do the same with my patients, but sometimes it is difficult without knowing them well to try to get to what do they think a good or bad doctor is. And sometimes I just have to rely on my own clinical.
Yeah, the answer would be generally, well, what are you looking for? What do you need from
a physician? Yeah, but sometimes that was a good example because there's a little more, you can understand the difference sometimes with a primary care doctor. But when I'm referring to a gastroenterologist, for instance, a patient, you know, I'm in my head going, I'm making my own decisions about do I want to pick someone who's going to order every test in the book? Or do I want to pick someone who's going to rely more on clinical judgment? Or do I want to pick someone who's super careful? Or do I want to pick someone who is going to do the minimal route because I don't think this is serious? And it's like they're very subtle differences. It's not never you go, I'm going to always pick the best, and the best is always the same answer.
What about my criteria, which is Jewish and female?
Well, there's lots of them, so you should be fine.
No. John?
Well, I would say one thing that follow-up is, Dr. Joe, I think as a primary care doctor, I think you're exactly right. The person has to be somebody that they identify with. And I agree with you. I don't want a doctor who's going to be warm and fuzzy and hold my hand.
Right.
But when you go to a specialist, there's some different thoughts there because they're not going to have a long – like you sent somebody in for a hernia surgery. They're not going to have a long-term relationship. You're going to send somebody who's done competent, you've seen the results, and you understand that. Would you agree?
Well, again, it's like you're sort of picking there. Look at this. I have a chronic GI illness and I have to pick a gastroenterologist, and I swear to you, the same things come into play. Do I want someone who's just going to check in with me once a year, where I just want to get in and get out, and I just want to know the tests, and I want to know how I can get to them, and I want to know that I can email her, and she's going to email me back? Is, like, is that the most important thing to me? Or, again, do I need a handholder? Do I need someone who's going to, like, am I nervous? Am I going to want my questions answered all the time? Am I going to want constant contact? Am I going to want to, like, feel like I'm being part of a family? These still occur. These are specialists, gastroenterologists, and there's a range of them. And I still, I don't ever think, like, this is the one person, the best, that I refer to. There are a number of people that I will refer to, often, again, based upon trying to figure out who is the best, you know, fit for this individual patient that is in front of me. It is, I wish it was so easy that we had, like, grades or some sort of classification where doctors were ranked 1 to 100 and that everybody could just start at the top and work their way down. It is incredibly subtle. And there are
How do you decide a kid comes into your office with chronic ear infections or chronic tonsil infections? How do you decide which ENT to send them to?
Well, again, so more often where I practice, there's really almost no choice. You have to remember, I work in a clinic where you know, people are often uninsured or you know, Medicaid or undocumented immigrants or something like that, and so therefore, you know, we send them to the only sort of practice that decides to cover us. But when my friends ask me, which is a different question, sure. When my friends say, "Hey, he's got an ear infection," I often say, "Look, well, where do you live?" Because, you know, sometimes the most important thing is, like, you know, I'm trying to pick the best doctor that I know that's local to them, because why would they want to traipse all the way downtown for something that I think is likely to be minor? Then I will often think about, oh, you know what, if you go here, I know the anesthesiologist is really good. And so, you know, because you want a pediatric anesthesiologist. And so I think that's almost more important, perhaps, than the ENT who's doing what's a very simple procedure.
Mm.
And so I will often, you know, actually refer far more often. I happen to know, like, one or two pediatric anesthesiologists who I think are phenomenal. And I feel like it's sometimes easier to measure anesthesiology in different ways. And so that would be much more important to me. But again, these are complex decisions that would run through my head that I don't think, you know, it is complex. It is not like, who's the best ENT? It's like, okay, well, who's the best ENT because I think you have an ear infection? And who's the best ENT because I really don't think you warrant this, but I know you're so worried about it, you want to see an ENT. I want to make sure I send you to an ENT who's a minimalist. Versus, I think this is a real problem. It's very rare. I know one guy who does absolutely the most of those. That's who I'm going to send you to. You know, I have a friend who's a, you know, pancreatic transplant surgeon. He's the only pancreatic transplant surgeon. So if I thought somebody needed something like that, of course I'm going to refer to him. But I wouldn't send anything else to him, even though he's a phenomenal surgeon.
That's the guy who used my computer backstage after seeing my show a few years ago and helped secure a pancreas for a patient. Using my computer, I deserve some of the credit.
But I mean, like, if somebody needed their gallbladder out, I'm not going to refer him to him, even though I think he's a phenomenal surgeon. I would think more among the guy that does, you know, gallbladders here.
John,
good work. I'll talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Great questions. Great conversation starter, and obviously Aaron with the thorough answers. Eric in Pennsylvania, you're on with Dr. Carroll.
Hi, Dr. Carroll. I got into a big discussion about Obamacare with two very smart people at a graduation party last weekend.
Fun.
One is a president of a company that probably employs about 40 people, and the other one is an administrator in a hospital.
Okay.
So the first question was that he was told that in 2017, the bill will come due for Obamacare, and we will find out exactly how bad it is.
What does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. So he said in that year, all health care plans would be made the level of a Cadillac plan, because any health care plan that your employer pays $2,000 or more for will become a Cadillac plan.
No, that is so not true.
Therefore, they'll have to pay taxes on it.
No.
Well, the employee will have to pay taxes on it.
Well, okay, first of all, let's way back up. So first of all, 2017 is when the excise tax kicks in, and then therefore every plan that is above the level of a Cadillac plan would have that tax applied only to the amount of money above the level of the Cadillac plan. But Cadillac plans that are set way higher than $2,000. while I talked to him.
I believe you said $27,000 on your health care
treatment. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think it's like 20. That sounds about right. So it's, let's say $27,000 for a family plan. The average employer-sponsored health care plan right now in the United States is $16,000. So we are nowhere near $27,000. And even if a plan costs, say, $28,000, the tax would only be applied on the $1,000 above.
Ah!
It's not the entire plan. It's the tax above. It's a marginal tax rate. So the tax would be on the amount above the Cadillac level. But
so if he's giving his people phenomenal health care,
well, then he should stop. What are they getting for $27,000 that they couldn't get for $25,000, considering that most of us have stuff that costs way less than that and it's pretty good insurance?
Okay, so here was the second thing he said. They're going to make this amnesty program for illegal immigrants.
What?
And 10 million illegal immigrants are suddenly going to be dumped onto Obamacare.
Well, again, let's back up for a moment. Okay, first of all, there's nothing in the law that does that. Could they pass a law in the future that would do that? Sure. But that would have to be through a Republican Congress, because last I checked, they have the House and they may have the Senate in the future. So then if he wants to direct his ire towards a future Congress that could theoretically allow illegal and undocumented immigrants into the Affordable Care Act health care system, that's not in the law now. That would have to be in the future. Certainly it's not going to happen this year. I can't imagine it happening in the next 2 years.
Did you?
So that's not going to happen. But I don't even want to back up. Because, first of all, you have 2 points there. First of all, what does that mean they would be dumped into Obamacare? Part of it might mean that, you know, that they would now qualify for Medicaid, and so that would be a direct – but the other thing is they would be allowed – right now, undocumented immigrants are not allowed to purchase insurance with their own money, private insurance, in the exchanges. They are prohibited. If we suddenly allowed them to buy private insurance with their own money in the exchanges, how would that hurt the government, or how would that hurt our fiscal bottom line? In essence, we would be allowing them to pay for the care that we're going to have to give them anyway if they go to the emergency room. Why would it not be a good fiscally conservative thing to allow them to pay for private insurance with their own money? So I don't even understand the idea of how that's a bad thing.
How did you get out of that conversation? How did it end? Did it get bad?
Well, I have to try to be very patient, because I'm obviously a left-winger, you know, I'm on the Democratic side.
Here's a good question you can ask him next time he does that. How stupid does he think American businesses are that they don't know that in 2017 this law is going into effect? Does he think that businesses haven't thought about this already and aren't already preparing for what's going to happen in 2017? Does he think that everyone who owns a corporation is so utterly dumb and unaware that on January 1st, 2017, they're suddenly going to wake up and see that the excise tax has kicked in? Does he not think that they're already working on solutions and preparing for the idea that insurance is going to have to stay under the level that's of the cap? I mean, how dumb does he think that private businesses are?
Well, the amazing part is I go back to what you say all the time, because their big thing is the prices jumped way up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, in the year before Obamacare, the prices jumped way up. Maybe you don't remember that every year you get an increase, and this is the only way we can kind of get a handle on those increases is to get more people into the pool, so we don't have these vague things out there that cost us money that insurance ends up paying for anyway.
But this is unfortunate. Also, the excise tax is one of those things that you know, it is a conservative argument that insurance is too robust, that insurance is too gold-plated, that it should be more like catastrophic with health savings accounts, and it should have higher deductibles and copays. Insurance that costs more than $27,000 has to be phenomenal. It must have removed the entire moral hazard from ever spending a dollar. You must be encouraged, likely, to spend as much money as possible. Conservatives would hate an insurance plan that costs more than $27,000. The Cadillac plan, the excise tax, tries to discourage us from providing insurance that is too expensive and too robust. Why is he against that?
Well, and just that, I don't know why he would be against it.
I would ask. I would argue with my friend like this, this is what I would say.
Go ahead, Eric.
I said, you need to get online and look at Dr. Aaron E. Carroll's staff, you know, healthcare triage, and really learn what this is about, because what you're saying is the exact opposite of what I've heard.
And that's why people like him, who are, you know, big job creators, you know, he's got 40 employees. This is information that would be advantageous to him. Eric, thank you. Anthony in North Carolina, thank you for waiting. You're on with Aaron Carroll.
How are you doing, Dr. Carroll?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Hey, first of all, Pete, I'd like to congratulate you. You seem well balanced today, and a good type. I don't know, emotional state. I know how you can do your therapy and everything else. You just seem less easily agitated today, and I wanted to.
It's not entertaining though if I'm not agitated, is it?
No, you're not usually, but you know, I've heard a couple of questions that are usually naturally agitated to you.
Well, thank you, Anthony. I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, but I'm pretty, yes. The therapy is working. I'm owning my emotional ground.
Or your yoga. I'm not doing yoga.
I should be, but the mindfulness, the therapy, and it's all working. I'm glad that you're noticing it. But people love it when the guy on the radio starts screaming at people. Now that's entertaining. Conflict is entertaining.
Yeah, well, I guess that depends on your perspective.
Well, it's also fake often, so. I do it, I like to say it's real. But go ahead, Anthony, with Aaron.
Well, first of all, Dr. Carroll, I'd like to thank you for coming on Pete's show. You know, I know most people don't actually say that to you. I mean, I'm
very polite, Anthony, but your phone is terrible, and I want you to get your question. I really appreciate all of your kind and generous comments, though.
Dr. Carroll, I ran into a predicament last week where my son's on a nebulizer for mild asthma. He takes nebulizer once a day. My prescription, my insurance has changed their policy without notifying me. Normally, I go once a month and pick up his medication at a local pharmacy.
Yep.
And now they're informing me without notification from my insurance that my insurance is requiring me to purchase it online in 3 to 4 months.
Yeah.
Quantity.
Welcome to my world. Yes. This is what happens to me. Go ahead.
I'm just curious why. I mean, that's a lot of money out of pocket. I'm not saving any money, and it seems I'm curious why the insurance is doing it. I mean, I've heard speculation.
Because they make money.
What's happening? The insurance is saying you have to buy your...
I can give you my own story, which will mirror the same thing. It's like I used to take a drug that was not like, you know, the common drug because it was for my illness. And after a while, they make deals for rarer... It's not advantageous for CVS to stock my medication. It's a pain in the butt because they don't use it that often. It's not like they're going to go through it like an antibiotic where it's probably like hundreds of times a day. And so they will often just have a pharmacy farther away that keeps medications that perhaps aren't as common or aren't as easily dispersed. Or medications that just, you know, they know are regular, and that way they can just run it like a warehouse. And so sometimes insurance companies will make deal with pharmaceutical, with like distribution companies to say, well, okay, fine, you're going to handle these medications for us. And instead of driving to the local Walgreens or CVS or pharmacy, you call or do it online and order it in like 3 month batches, and you do it online and they ship it to you. And that way it's like Amazon. It's not like, you know, it's not like a bread and butter store that's anywhere. It's like centralized warehouses. And that provide some efficiency of scale. They can make a better deal, the insurance companies, with the distribution companies. It saves them some money. Theoretically, they should pass that savings on to you. And that is how many people with chronic illness get their drugs. Sometimes there's a savings. And so it's not always a terrible thing for patients because if you order it sometimes 3 month batches, but sometimes it's not. And when they do it without notifying you, it's very, very frustrating.
Anthony wasn't notified and he's not saving anything.
No, and then that is unbelievably frustrating, but the reason they do it is because it is more efficient for them and it saves them money.
But it's a huge cost out of my pocket. Instead of paying $70-$80 a month, I'm having to fork out $400 at one period point. Mm. And on top of that, you know, we always go in a week before, you know, he runs out, you know, in a 1 month batch. And, you know, it takes longer than a week to order. So now I'm in a pinch where he doesn't have his daily medication.
Wow.
Yep.
Anthony, really sorry to hear about that. I'm so glad that you brought it up and mentioned it as an issue. I want to quickly go to Diane in Maryland. We've got to take a break. Diane.
Hi there.
Hi, Diane.
I want to go back to the comment about doctors referring to facilities that they have ownership in.
Yep.
I live in Maryland, and whenever my husband and I are outsourced to a facility where a doctor has an ownership in, you know, where, whether it be a surgical center or some other procedure, we sign something that acknowledges that fact. Do you know if that's a state law?
Yes, probably yes, because you have to remember that most, like, healthcare systems and stuff like that, they're regulated at a state level, so that is likely a state law.
Oh, okay. All right. Because I think it's awesome, and not that we would change, but it's just it's a nice thing to know.
Because I think in some states it's actually just prohibited. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an expert. I would imagine that is a state law. Someone may prove me wrong, but I think it is a state law. They may someday pass federal law which trumps it and, like, you know, sort of makes it everybody has that. But it is, I think, very different still state to state how those things are allowed.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back with the rest of your calls. Dr. Aaron Carroll is joining us. Got to talk about a number of the articles that he's recently published, specifically how we call something a disease, even when it's not, what that means for you and for the cost of the care. We'll be right back with Aaron Carroll. Hopefully you're following him on Twitter. He's getting back to people on Twitter while he's talking to other people. The guy can multitask. We'll be right back.
A man who's excited to welcome any guest who promise him a retweet. Stand up with Pete Dominic.
Well, we got through a lot of calls in the first half of this hour. Love to get through some more. 866-994-6343. Join the conversation. Follow Dr. Aaron Carroll on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. He joins us to take your calls, questions, and arguments almost every Wednesday, and we really appreciate that. Watch his healthcare triage videos. People are sharing so many of those with their friends. This week it's tort reform. Go to healthcare triage on YouTube. The number 9 story the Week magazine thinks you need to know today, Aaron Carroll, is the CDC warns that restaurants are a main source of norovirus.
Okay.
The real threat of the nasty norovirus is not on cruise ships, despite a flurry of reports of outbreaks on board. According to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in reality, far more of the 20 million annual infections from the highly contagious gut bug are contracted in restaurants.
Yeah, okay, so here's a way of, like, you got to think about the numbers. So I don't doubt that overall the chance of getting norovirus is large, you know, there are more people that get norovirus worldwide from in the country from restaurants than cruise ships, but that's partly because many more people go to restaurants than to go to cruise ships. If, however, you were on a cruise ship where there is norovirus, almost everybody gets it, and that's, it spreads so quickly that so many people get it that...
What is it?
That's when you hear about it. That's that virus you hear about when someone gets sick on a cruise ship and everybody, it's a terrible, terrible
thing. Then they crap all over the ship.
It's like diarrhea and vomiting, and it spreads like wild.
There's poop everywhere all over the ship.
Yeah, and I am positive that Amy Jacob and I had it.
Really?
Years and years and years ago, and it was not on a cruise ship. Oh, yeah. It was horrible. The closest I've ever come to going to an ER.
But the other statistic there, you've never been to an ER for anything?
I've been to ERs for, like, broken bones and stuff, but I was so dehydrated that Amy got scared.
I would have loved to just stand there and make fun of you.
Horrible.
But the other thing, though, there is that, you know, so many of the people that get norovirus get it from restaurants. Does that mean, based on those stats, I shouldn't eat at restaurants?
No, this is the thing. It's like, but you eat at restaurants all the time. People go on cruise ships like once in a lifetime. It's like, it's closed quarters where people are, you know, in a restaurant, it's going to affect a small number of people probably before they catch it and implement stuff and then make sure that nobody else gets it. On a cruise ship, there's no escape. That's the problem. And so it is a much... You know, it's sort of that's when you hear about it, and that's when you get huge outbreaks all at one time. At restaurants, probably it's smaller outbreaks that get picked up and fixed much more quickly.
I was thinking about you the other day as I was stepping into the shower. The two aren't related, but I remember that's where I was when I was thinking about you. And I was like, you know, I bet you Aaron, someone like Aaron that knows so much about health and you debunk all these myths and so on, there's got to be so many choices that you make based on the knowledge that you have. And obviously you always talk about moderation with anything from soda to alcohol to drugs. But is there anything that you think that that any choice that you make every day or often that you think, you know, most of us probably don't know, some piece of knowledge that you've got through your research, through your career, that you say, you know what, I'm never going to do that, or I'm rarely going to do that, whether it has to do with exercise or therapy or certainly diet? Is there some little thing about washing hands or?
It's actually probably, well, okay, so the one thing that I do religiously that I'm very cognizant of is whenever I'm going to pick up a baby, I wash my hands. Like, it's just one of those things where it's like when a friend has a baby or you know, my niece was born this year, something like that, I'm very careful to wash my hands because that is the way that you're going to do it. But I think that almost always the knowledge works the other way. I'm much more likely not to be worried about something.
Oh, okay.
And I think most of my friends or family are.
That's interesting.
You know,
yeah.
I'm much more easily to put things in perspective to realize it's like, I know everyone's panicked about that, but the likelihood is really so small that why are you worried?
So you deal with probabilities with almost all your choices.
So it's almost always a risk probability assessment. But in the end, it's like so many things are just really not that dangerous or really not that safe in the scheme of things that I err on the side. I'm trying to think of something.
Do you always wear your seatbelt?
I do always wear my seatbelt because you know what that. So there you go.
You wear your seatbelt in the back.
Always, because again, the number one killer, and it's one of the few that's like totally unpredictable, and you can't fix it. It's like because you know everybody thinks, oh, if I drive safe, I'm going to be fine, but it's not you that's the problem; it's the other guy. And you know, almost every time I've been in an accident, it's someone hitting me. In fact, I've never been at fault for an accident. It's always been somebody else. But so driving safely doesn't protect me. It's out of my control. And I think that, like, I'm much more concerned about wearing a seatbelt in the car than I am on a plane by far.
But you've admitted on air even that you drank too much and threw up.
Yeah.
Not too long ago, maybe last year. Where was it?
Did I admit that on air?
Yeah. You said you barfed. Shouldn't you know better?
But again, like risks and benefits. It's like, what was the harm? It's like, did I have a great time? I don't even know what you're doing. The sad part is I'm not even sure.
I think that was when you were in New York, wasn't it?
Did I tell you the story? Oh, probably, that was probably Amy telling the story because I don't think it was that recently. But I know, in fact, if I know which one she's complaining about.
You throw up in the car.
I had a phenomenal time before it ended. So I think the benefit outweighed.
Fair enough. All right, two pieces I know I want to ask you about before I go back to the phones. And one of them is the piece about politics and physicians. And this is at the Incidental Economist. What's this about?
So I love stuff like this. So someone did went back and looked at because all like political contributions are open and online. They went back and actually looked at who physicians donate to, because I find that sort of the politics of physicians, I just find it to be fascinating because one, it's changed so much over time, and it's changing so much as the demographics of physicians change. But you know, physicians used to be very solidly Republican. And so if you look back in the past, there were fairly high numbers of physicians who were donating to Republicans. Interestingly enough, very few physicians used to actually donate, like in the low 2%, not that long ago, even lower. But it very, very...
Meaning not that the physicians weren't necessarily generous, that they didn't find... They didn't see a need to donate to political campaigns.
First of all, that's not charity. Let's not be silly about that.
That's
so
good
they
point.
Weren't... They could be very generous. They just weren't giving to political campaigns.
That's a great point, yes.
That over time has been shifting. One, in the number of physicians who have been giving to political campaigns has gone up. I think it was 10% or close to 10% in the most recent elections. But it has actually shifted in the last two presidential campaigns to be Democratic, favoring Democratic. And in fact, it used to be all men donating. Now it is many more women, and the women heavily lean Democratic. And I have like just a little nice chart there just showing in the last election or two how that has split men and women. So as more and more women become physicians, they are definitely leaning way Democratic, and it's probably driving the shift that of all physicians overall are favoring donating to Democratic campaigns. So does that mean that they are all Democrats? Nope. Could be that the Democrats are more likely to donate, the Republicans, I don't know. But it's the kind of thing that I always like to think of whenever you get a caller, and it happens, everyone will call and be like, all doctors hate the ACA. And I'm like, well, first of all, you know, whether or not people like the ACA, I think just in a gut reaction, it almost always comes down to politics. I just encounter very few people who lean left who hate it, except for the far left, and who lean right and love it. And so there comes down the pot. But this is the kind of like data point where you're like, well, you know, you just assume that all doctors are Republican or all doctors are conservative or all doctors hate the ACA. That's just never been, that's never borne out in actual research. And here's another data point that just shows it's a mistake to just assume all doctors lean Republican or that all doctors lean Democrat. It's much more complex. They are humans like anyone else. Being physicians or being wealthier is not the only driver in how people choose their political philosophy. And it's always good to have data. And this is certainly interesting stuff and worth looking at.
The other piece I wanted to mention is the piece at the New York Times, Upshot, where you're a contributor now, about diseases and what we call diseases. And when we call something a disease, that immediately we have to find a solution for it. We have to create drugs for it, therapies for it, and so on. And we then all have to go use them. Really, really interesting statistics in this piece. I'm sure it got a lot of traffic because it's a really important issue, right?
It did, surprisingly, and that's very rewarding. Yes, I mean, I think this is just one of my hobby horses that I've always felt badly about. In fact, I think I even mentioned in the piece, this goes all the way back to residency when, you know, we would see so many babies at the hospital or in clinics who were coming in because they were spitting up a lot, and we were calling it gastroesophageal reflux, and we were then prescribing them these foam wedges that our OTPT department would construct and charge people $150 for. And I was, my outrage came very quickly in my medical career. I was outraged and I couldn't believe we were charging so much for these. And I wanted to know where the evidence was for that they work. And everybody swore to me that they worked. And I was sure that it was garbage. And my first ever published research paper, was I did a systematic review of all the evidence that showed these therapies, these things we do for reflux, do they work or not? It turns out none of them worked. That was the first paper I ever had published.
Mm.
And this has been like my, you know, hobby. Babies spit up. Like, you know, over half a baby spit up twice a day or more. And, you know, almost every baby is going to have spit up at some point. It's not a disease. Almost all of them, like 95% of them, resolve without anything going on, without anything ever interacting, without ever having to do anything. And yet we construct these therapies. And then, you know, as the PPI, as the proton pump inhibitors came out, we started giving them drugs for something that wasn't a disease. The diagnosis of the disease has been going up faster and faster. The rate at which we're prescribing these medications goes up. And they've done, these drugs have never been approved ever for babies younger than a year of age, or infants younger than a year of age. Why? Because they don't work. There have been randomized controlled trials of PPIs in infants that show they get absolutely no benefit from them, and they have significantly more side effects, including respiratory infections, like lower respiratory infections. So you're more likely to give them pneumonia, and they will get no benefit. The research absolutely shows that, and is why the FDA has never approved that. Nonetheless, you know, prescriptions for this have skyrocketed.
So, and, you know, I think you just enlightened me on something that I had no idea. So the FDA, rather a drug manufacturer, can sell a drug?
They cannot sell it that way. They cannot advertise it for this. They cannot license it and do anything else. But they can. This is again, we should have a whole episode just discussing this. That doesn't mean that, like, they can't talk about it, or that, like, you know, that the, you know, that their drug people can't go out and talk about it. And doctors all the time prescribe stuff, quote unquote, off label. They are totally allowed to do so. There's nothing that stops them from doing so. And so doctors all the time write prescriptions for PPIs, quote unquote, off label for infants, even though there's never been an absolute approval. The reason they need the FDA approval for that would be so that they could advertise and try to get, like, patent coverage.
But why do doctors ever prescribe drugs, or do they not know it, that aren't approved by the FDA?
Because, well, they're approved for the FDA. The FDA doesn't just approve a drug. The FDA approves it for a drug for a certain purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have absolutely been approved for you know, heartburn and all those things, and, you know, everything that can be associated with that for adults and even for kids, I think, down to 1 year of age. They have never been approved for infants because that would be another thing that they would need a study to show.
So they've never been approved for infants, and yet doctors prescribe them.
You've just described a whole host of drugs, because why is it in the drug company's best interest sometimes to do those studies if doctors are going to prescribe them anyway? The only reason that they would go for those extra studies, which cost money, don't get me wrong, they cost money to do those studies, would be because they would be able to advertise that, or they could lock up, you know, a market for a period of time and get a, you know, on patent for something. So some of these drugs, it's just not worth it. They do a calculation. This is one of the reasons why years ago there was a huge push to try to entice more drug companies to actually do studies in children, because almost all the drugs we have are studied only in adults. We don't know what happens to kids. We just assume. We know, we back it up. We do it off-label, and we just assume. No one acts. If we could only prescribe drugs to kids that it's been specifically studied in kids would be in big trouble.
What do you think of the idea of putting a warning label on sugary drinks?
What would the warning label say?
I don't know.
Well, that's where we would have to discuss it. In other words, if they put a warning label on that said, hey, this drink is filled with needless calories, it could lead to your gaining weight, I think that we can make an argument that that would be possible, but why would we only pick sugared beverages? Why not pie and cake?
Because they're not consumed at the rate that sugary drinks are?
What's the rate? What rate do you set it at?
Every single day? Do people have cake?
You'd be surprised. I think some people do.
Melanie, is there something you wanted to say? Melanie's
more like cookies, but I'm always down for cake, too.
I mean, there is a snack cake industry.
Yeah.
And bakeries seem to be everywhere.
Ask little Debbie.
Donuts? Why does Dunkin' Donuts be allowed to sell donuts? The only purpose of Dunkin' Donuts is to sell you something that's full of sugar, carbs, and fat. There's no redeem. Like, what? Why? You know, Entenmann's. Why not pie companies?
Are we eating less healthy, or are we exercising that much less?
Where to go? Well, okay. So I don't think it's the exercise. In fact, it's ironic. I'm reading this book right now that I truly got to wrap my head around, and we should have a long conversation when I'm done. But
what's it called?
It's called The Big Fat Surprise. I understand many of the arguments that are being made against it, but I have to sort of figure out for myself if a lot of the claims made about the research and diet are right or wrong. This is one of those where exercise, we're not doing so badly with respect to exercise. I mean, we've gotten the message out. Adults are exercising more and more every day. It's not fixing the obesity problem. I think it's got to be much more related to diet than anything else, by far.
Do you think that...
wrong with our diet? This is where it gets controversial. I think that there's a lot of new evidence that shows we have no freaking idea. That we keep, we went down this road of it's saturated fats, it's fats, it's trans fats, it's all this stuff. And it might be that it's carbs. I don't have a good answer. I think anyone that thinks they know the answer is...
Why is that so difficult to figure out?
Because I wish I could tell you, because I honestly think that, we just eat so differently. I read a great paper recently that tried to look at this holistically, and a lot of the problem may be that, food is cheaper than it's ever been, and it's more ubiquitous than it's ever been. Mm. We're just eating so much more than it's ever been, and it could be much more of a policy societal problem than an individual
level.
Which macronutrient we're eating.
Do you think junk food manufacturers should be able to advertise target kids and advertise directly at them?
Well, what should I do? I think they should be able to. Like, I mean, that's a legal question. I don't know if I have the answer for that.
The answer is no. Thank you, though, for weighing in. I mean, I could have told you the answer is no. As always, we value and appreciate your time today, sir. Aaron Carroll, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
At Aaron E. Carroll. Thank him there. Follow him there. Watch the Healthcare Triage videos. Share them with your friends on Facebook and everywhere else. We'll talk to you right here tomorrow on Stand Up. Thanks so much for tuning in and being the change you want to see in the world.